Hello everyone, it's Walter Wong here with the Bold But Gold podcast. In Bold But Gold, we speak to Singaporeans who are taking a risk and making bold choices. Now, many of you will know my guest on this episode, or would have at least consumed his snacks. Chris Huang is the co-founder of The Golden Duck, the company behind those delicious salted egg fish skin snacks, among others. Chris is also a Forbes 30 Under 30 entrepreneur. But in today's episode, you're going to hear from him like you've never heard him before. For instance, do you know that he used to go to the Singapore Sports School and was working towards being a professional bowler? In our conversation, Chris opens up about his life, which has been eventful to say the least. His path to the Golden Duck took him through success and failure in equal measure, and also included a momentous decision to drop out of law school. Stay tuned to find out about how that conversation went with his parents. Now, Chris and I have known each other for years, but we haven't had time to catch up about his journey, so it was a privilege to finally have this conversation. We caught up in Chris's office, which was a hive of activity. I loved the vibe around me, but I made one mistake. I started our conversation by talking about the interior design of the office. For an audio medium, that's a bit counterintuitive, but I invite you to close your eyes, take a seat next to us, and have a listen.
Well, Chris, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for agreeing to speak. We're seated here in your wonderful office. I like the grey tones.
Yeah.
The muted grey tones.
Cozy, very good to sleep.
I guess let's start here. I do want to talk about your journey here, but let's just start here for a second. And when you look around, you've grown a team rapidly since just, I think, started in 2015, right?
2015.
So you've grown rapidly. How does it make you feel right now?
The Golden Duck has grown from like 3 people in 2015.
Yeah.
Now we have like maybe 150 plus people, including contract staff, part timers. It's exciting. It's a lot of responsibility. I am enormously proud of the team. They achieved this. It's not just me, it's not just John.
Yeah.
It's huge. And I think what they continue to do every day is to surprise me as to how ready they are to take up the next challenge. Like just today I was talking to like my finance team, and they're ready to move forward to the next stage of growth. And that's very exciting.
Yeah. I think it's quite impressive because, I mean, at least just observing from in here, I suppose, like, the ownership looks super high.
They own it, man. Excited. They own it. They're their own bosses. They call me boss to annoy me. So, yeah.
So, boss, man.
Yeah, no, please don't do that. They run their work.
Yeah.
They own it. They absolutely crush it.
But that is, okay, so let's come back to this later. But let's, I guess, take a step all the way back. You know, we sort of went through the same schooling system, I suppose. And as you would know, a lot of our friends are lawyers in the corporate world. You don't get, I would say, many risk takers. So I guess I'm curious about what maybe from your growing up years, I think you always seem to be quite entrepreneurial, you're telling me about that, like what in your growing up years I suppose started you on this path of wanting to do your own thing?
Yeah, I guess to some extent I was born to be a dropout.
Yeah.
Like I was always a bit of a stupid kid. Book smart-ish, but really just didn't like the system. I never wanted to conform. In fact, when I was like 12 years old, sitting for the PSLE, the only one excuse I could have to leave my table was to go bowling, because that was my sport at the time. And I made my parents strike a deal with me that if I would train, they would let me off the hook.
Okay.
So I trained. I trained the week before PSLE for no competitions. I just trained because I didn't want to study.
So did you love bowling, or was it because you just didn't want to study?
I don't know, man. I really hated the idea of being chained to a desk. And yeah, I didn't want to study.
And then you said you were selling like yo-yos or something, or Pokemon.
That happened. So I had a few non-businesses. They were like micro-businesses.
Yeah.
I sold Pokemon Sketches when it came out when I was 10 years old. I earned a total of $2.
Very good.
Yeah, absolutely. Best business.
$2 back then though.
Because it was not my pencil, not my paper. So it's net profit.
So someone drew it for you and you sold it?
I drew it.
Oh, you drew it? Okay.
My parents are pay for the pencils, right? So it's 100% net profit. I love it. And I tried to sell yo-yos when I was 14. I discovered that you could bring them in the carton for about $200 a carton, and you could sell them. Which means I would buy a yo-yo at $14. A store would sell it for $22 to $28. I could sell it for $18 to $20, and
so
I would
net the
difference.
You still make a margin, yeah.
Yeah, I would net the difference as a profit. That was the first time I ever learned the pain of inventory management.
Wait, so you were buying it from Amazon or something? And
I can't remember. I think I just bought it from a distributor warehouse in Singapore.
Impressive.
And yeah, it sucked because I was left with $200 of yo-yos and I didn't want to play with that many yo-yos. So first business, the big loss.
So you basically learned from your well, mini failures, I suppose, but you couldn't...
failures to me as a kid, man. $200 at 14 years old is a lot of money.
Yeah. But this was when you were in sports school.
Yeah, I was in sports school.
Okay, I guess for most people who don't know this, you were in sports school for like, what, 5 years? Four years or five years?
5 years. So sports school is a typical secondary school program.
Yeah.
I entered, obviously, through bowling.
Yeah.
Right? The story just now tells you I was kind of dedicated to it, even if it was only escape from studies. I got in when I was 13. I went through the sports school system till I was 16. And at 16 years old, I decided I wanted to be a professional bowler. So I went...
So that was the original dream, actually.
It was one of them. I mean, I had a few. It's quite crazy. And I'm quite impressed with my parents for actually supporting me and saying, like,
what were the others besides bowling?
I wanted to be a pastor, so let's not go there.
Pastor? Okay, come on, let's drop that for a second.
Interesting. So at 16 years old, I decided I wanted to do the whole professional circuit thing. And I dropped my O-level, so I didn't do it. Halfway through the program, when I was 17, I discovered that professional bowling was not for me. Obviously, as decisive as a kid can be, I dropped in and I asked Raffles if they would take me in, and they said you needed an O-level cert. So I went back to sports school and I begged them, and they're like, yeah, you're a pretty smart kid, you can come in, we'll let you take the O-levels again.
So they let you back in.
So
really,
I took the
O-levels
for the first time,
yeah.
But I was doing Sec 4 for the second time. Graduated and went on to Raffles after that. But
I think that's when I first started playing tennis with you, or might have been after you graduated, I think. But.
So when I was 18 in year 1 JC, I was in Raffles there. That was the first time I was exposed to other sports other than bowling, because I'm no longer 100% committed. I don't train twice a day. I can explore things, and I loved tennis. I still love tennis. And that's when I picked up my racket and started bugging poor people like you to play with me.
We played a lot back then.
We played a lot.
I was always a bit surprised. I guess I never asked you this, but like, did you still love bowling? Or because it's a very quick drop, right? To go from wanting to become pro and then the next year you're just like, okay, no, you know.
I love bowling as a sport. What I don't like is the system that's built around it. I think to be competitive in bowling, you're going to have to give a lot in terms of sacrificing hours, time, social life. You're going to really build a life around bowling. And I think at that point, for the amount of wins that I was looking at, you know, really getting into Asian Games, SEA Games, both games I didn't ever go for.
So you didn't make it? Or
yeah, I never made it to those games, right? I made it just one level below, the Asian Youth Games. Which is like the Junior Olympics for, you know, that thing. Yeah, I figured at that point it was either go all in again with no certain outcome, and for a sport that I loved, there was no guaranteed results, because bowling is not like track and field where you're going to post a time and you know what you're going to run plus minus 0 point something seconds, right? Bowling is like, I can throw a strike today and I can throw the exact same shot
and
tomorrow and you're going to get a split. There's no guarantee of success, which is very much like life. But I digress.
So has the Golden Duck basically become your bowling now?
Wow, I don't know, man. I think Golden Duck is really a vindication to all the failures that I've had. So after sports school, I went to Raffles. I started my first business in Army. I started three other businesses since then, and all of them I've exited in 2016 or 2017 to focus on Golden Duck full-time. Quite a number of those businesses have crashed and burned.
Mm-hmm.
And either very bad investments or tough business partners to work with, or just difficult businesses to do. Golden Duck is a vindication that you can make it.
To me, one of the most interesting things that I think when we talked about this was maybe, what was this, 5 years ago when we talked about you were in law school, and I was like, I think it makes sense, you had Golden Duck on the side and then you were in law school, and then I remember you told me you dropped out of law school, and I was like, wow, that's quite shocking to me.
Yeah, anyone would do that.
So obviously I know why you did it, to focus on the business, but like, how did it feel back then? Was it really nerve-wracking?
It was a heavy conversation
with your parents
to deliver to my parents, because I wasn't asking for permission, but it was a short conversation, so thank God for that.
They accepted it.
They didn't have a choice. I didn't ask them, I told them.
But I mean, they can still not accept it.
No, they couldn't. They would just have to kick me out. And I was ready to accept that. I took a gap year from school in 2016, mid of 2016, August, right? The school year in NUS. Golden Duck at that time had two or three stores, and we weren't selling in any 7-Elevens, but the business was growing. It was growing to a stage that I wasn't ready to cut law school as a backup, but it was growing at a stage where I could not ignore the business. So that's what I did. I took 1 year off. 2016 August to 2017 July, the business expanded so rapidly. We started selling in 7-Eleven.
Your sales went by how? I mean, you don't have to give me the exact numbers, but
like 600 to 700%.
Oh wow! Okay.
Stupid growth. And at 2017, I had to make the call that this was going to be a more fulfilling roller coaster ride than I would have achieved in a career in law. So I made the call and I told my dad, "Hey dad, you know, I'm dropping out." And that was that. It helps a lot that there were publications like Forbes 30 Under 30. They wrote about us, and I mean, to this day, I don't really know what puts us on that map, but thankfully, some people want to write about us, and like you want to interview us on podcast, so that's cool.
Yes.
But that validation really helped my parents understand what we're doing, because more so with the generation above them, so grandparents and all that, without the Business Times, without Straits Times, without Forbes, they would not be able to accept that what I'm doing is making a career for myself.
So you and your business partner, Jonathan Shin, both of you were on the Forbes 30 Under 30, right? I guess, do you know who nominated you, or was it...
To this day, I actually don't know who nominated us. It could have been friends, could have been John's friends.
Mm-hmm.
I personally felt we weren't ready for the 30 Under 30.
And that happened before you dropped out of law school, or in the sabbatical year?
Well, it happened in the sabbatical year. So 2017 was when they announced, I think in April or March, that the Forbes 30 Under 30, we made it. So that made the dropping out a little bit easier, because in July I was like, hey, you know, we got Forbes, not that bad. You know, people don't mind writing about us, so our business got to be some form of legit, right? And that was the dropout. So that was a heavy conversation, but it was a quick one.
So you were, in the army, so we come back to the business that you were talking about. So in the army and law school, you started a few businesses in different industries.
It was small. I didn't have money.
So I know you did Vice. That was a nightclub that was at the South Bank.
Vice was in... Clarke Quay. So Vice is actually the club that is now Zouk.
I thought Zouk moved out.
Moved out of Jack Kim. So Zouk moved into Clarke Quay, and they took over that space, which was Vice. Yeah, Vice was in 2014 when I was 22 years old. Yeah. That's when we started Vice.
It's you and Jonathan as well?
Yeah, me and Jonathan and a few other partners, we started Vice. That was the first time I ever worked with John. I met him a couple of years earlier, and we really aligned on business principles, values, how do you treat people, ethics. And what do you want out of life in terms of where do you want to go with your business? Back then, he was in events, and I was doing impressionist. I was still studying, but I was doing my first business impressionist, which was in education. So very, very fast stretch, education to events. But we said, you know, the values align, and if one day we can do something together, we should. So the opportunity opened up in 2014, and we started Vice in December.
I know you talked about there were some difficulties. I mean, you don't have to go into it, but basically, was it your choice to exit, or was it forced on you?
It's fine. I'm not too shy about the details anymore.
Yeah.
It's behind us. So Vice was a big problem, because when we started that club and we poured all that investment into that location, the master lease was held by Life Brands, which as a group wasn't doing well. They were about 1.5 to 2 million in arrears when we signed the lease. And anybody who knows how arrears works will understand that at that point, it's going to snowball. It's going to get worse. They're going to get their master lease pulled very, very soon.
Did you know this when you were...
We did not know this. So we were actually set up. And I think that's a different story for a different time. There's still potential legal action there, but I'm choosing to leave it for now, right? Vice was a nightmare for any investor, because the club was operationally in the black. We were making money. But it died such a quick and horrible death because it was set up badly. It was set up under a master lease that was not ready to run.
So then the lease got basically swept under you.
That's right.
And then Zouk came in.
And it's gone.
Interesting.
So the club was operationally green. It was doing pretty decently for a club at that point in 2014, 2015. But it wasn't given the chance to breathe. It's like a stillborn. And
how big was your team at that point in time?
In Vice?
Yeah.
I think the team,
I mean
was,
the permanent, the full time team.
Full time team was probably about 15 people.
And have you brought them over?
We have some people with us, right? We have some people who have joined us from the Massive Collective team. I think we've got an eye for good talent. Some good folks here.
Yeah.
I don't want to drop names just in case again.
No, of course not. But so it's quite interesting because, like, again, I guess different perspectives, right? As a non risk taker, non entrepreneur.
Yeah.
If I had a failure, I wouldn't call it a failure, but if I had difficulties,
it was a failure.
Like,
call it what it is.
Well, I mean, it wasn't a failure of your doing, I would say. So if I had that on me, I think I would stop. I would give up.
Yeah.
But you didn't.
I should. I wouldn't say I should, but anyone with their right mind should learn from the fire that.
So why did you not?
So, I was not ready. I was not ready to call it quits, and I think I poured my inheritance into Vice. That was not a pleasant feeling to see it disappear like that. It's gone. In 2015, I tried to pull together a business deal that would save those losses, that would make it all back. And that was the second nightclub. It was called Suite 26. And that was at South Beach.
So that was the one I knew about. Okay.
That's right.
I knew about Vice, but I thought Vice was at South Beach, actually.
Yeah. So Vice was the Clark Quay one. Suite 26 was at South Beach. And we opened that nightclub. What I did was I tried my best, and I did actually succeed in brokering a suite deal for equity. Right, the equity was better there than anywhere else. I had preference in terms of payments. So as far as dividends were concerned, I was first right. So that was good. I actually brokered what I believe was a superior deal. I could have actually gotten my returns from Vice, from South Beach. Now the difference here is this was no longer my money. This was my parents' money. And I went to them with a full business proposal. Unfortunately, they're not good business people, so don't trust them on deals. I love you, Dad. But they approved that business proposal. Right, and for all intents and purposes, it was a good deal. But you don't know what you don't know. There was pilfering, there was theft, there was I won't go into details, Suite was not well run as an organization.
Wait, so you were an equity partner in this?
I was an equity partner.
But they were an existing company that you saw.
That's right. The management was Massive Collective, and Massive Collective didn't manage it well. So that was Suite. That burned not only my money and the returns it was supposed to get me, but it also burned my parents' money. And this was the first time that I was actually out of pocket. You know, this is no longer something that I'm entitled to as an inheritance. It's no longer something that I earned. It's no longer my life savings. This is my parents' money.
How much did they put in? How much did you put in? How much did they? I mean,
it was a total of $250,000
from you
into
and your parents.
Into Suite, that's right.
Okay,
it's
huge.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I call it the biggest MBA that they've ever put down. And that was big. It left my bank account with very little left, and that with whatever little was left, I started Golden Duck. And I just refused to quit. What is important is to note the chronological order of these events. In 2014, I lost big with Vice. It was such a huge loss.
Yeah.
But in 2015, when Suite started, Suite wasn't an immediate loss. The club actually, for those that know in the clubbing scene, 2015 September until well into 2016, Suite was the club to go to. And it did well. But I didn't take that for granted. I started three other businesses. So there was Suite, there was Upcom, which was a media agency, which also closed because that's difficult to scale in Singapore.
Media agency meaning like content production?
No, we were handling talents.
Got it. Okay.
Like DJs.
Got it.
Right? And that's difficult to do in Singapore. It's not really scalable. At least not with our skill sets.
I mean, you need to be an
right?
IMG or something.
You have to be big. You have
yeah.
to be big. And we started the Golden Duck. I was also concurrently doing law school. So at this point, I'm not as badass as Elon Musk going out there and, you know, I'm just going to invest 100% of what I got. I'm going to borrow money for rent. I'm not that crazy. So I just worked double, triple as hard as anyone could have, and killed my entire social life. I didn't have one, and I poured myself into the businesses.
So did Jonathan follow you from, I mean not follow you, but you both worked together from Vice?
We both worked together in Vice, we both worked together in Suite, we both did Upcom together, and
So who at Golden so Duck. I know that Golden Duck was, I mean if I have a portion idea, I would say it's his idea originally.
John was the one that first proposed this idea. He said, hey, you know what? You can do salted egg yolk on chips. Like, isn't that a scalable business? And I thought that he was trying to get me to sell nachos, like a dip. And I was like, that is not a scalable idea because you're trying to sell jars of dips. That's stupid.
Yeah.
He said, no, 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 hold on, I've got a friend, you can make it happen. They're just going to package goods with real salted egg on it. And I said, well, I don't mind, I like salted egg, I'll give it a try. So we met up and we did the deal. That's the long story short. That was another 6 months of hell.
But
of
you guys
R&D.
Didn't bring in the guy who is his friend who could do the manufacturing.
We did, but we exited that. Let's not talk about
okay,
that.
Okay, let's not go there.
So it was John's idea to begin with, right? And originally my job was just to be an investor, because in all the other projects my role was an investor.
But so in the other projects, who was the ideas guy? Was it John? Like, for example, Upcom?
It was between Upcom was a joint idea from us.
Okay.
We had watched a bit too much American TV and thinking that the media life was the life to go for. Yeah, totally different. Hollywood and Singapore, it's a different place.
Yeah.
So we share the ideas. I would say John takes most of them, to be very honest. I'm usually the guy that takes these ideas and scales them and makes them real.
So it was basically about 6 months between the idea coming and producing the first pack.
Yeah, that's right. In those 6 months, we learned about research and development. We learned about putting a shelf life on these products. We learned about different types of packaging that you can and cannot use for food. We learned about shelf life. We learned about AVA, our
regulatory
agency. Yep. You got to Google these things, man. And Google helped us a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you, Alphabet.
So it was just two of you researching these products, sampling the thing, trying to run the other businesses at the same time.
Just trying to get everything done. It's crazy. You don't sleep. You eat a lot of chips, but you stress about every single thing that's coming your way and you can't stop going. I think that's what entrepreneurship is about. The ability to keep going.
Yeah. Failures come up, keep going.
Yeah. There are things that are going to get you stuck. That doesn't mean you stop moving. You just leave it for later and you go do something else first. So if like your AVA license isn't coming through, that's fine. I'll work on R&D. I'll work on packaging. I'll work on design. I'll work on storefronts. What stores, where are we going to sell these things? Right? There's 101 problems. And if you let any one of them get you stuck, you're never going to finish.
Yeah. So when you guys first, I guess, incorporated Golden Duck, in your plan, did you have an idea of when you thought you were going to break even?
No, we didn't. Yes. We actually did a very thorough projections plan, as we did for all businesses. The plan lasted us for about 2 to 3 months. After that, we outgrew it. That was a real miracle break for us. I think what we really underestimated was the Singaporeans' ability to hunt down and go after good food with rigor.
Yes.
They don't stop, man. When they know something is good, and up to this day, we haven't cut our salted egg in our recipes. In fact, we've added, right? You know, so we're giving more value to the customers. But I think that's the way it goes. You give them the best product that you can give, and the people that recognize it are gonna give right back. They're gonna be loyal to you.
When you first, I guess if you look on the internet, like, this is what it looks like in general. Did it look like this at the start?
No, very, very different.
Was it a box or something?
If you look all the way in the far corner of the room, there's a few old packets there. That's version 3.
Okay.
So
I recognize that.
Yeah.
I recognize that.
We had versions all the way from version 1. Let me see if I can find
it. So it basically just looks different.
It looks recognizable. The duck is recognizable. The brown pack is recognizable. But there was no color on it. It was very mundane, very simple. But at the same time, very hipster, very chic, very subtle, right?
So, and you guys at the start decided, okay, you were going to go to market with this, and you were going to go through your own distribution channel. So like, you guys only recently, well not recently, only over the last maybe year or so have gone to supermarkets,
yeah? Yeah, we first went to 7-Eleven in December 2016. So it's been about a year and a half.
So it was purely
almost
your
2 years,
own,
actually.
So you
almost
built your own
years.
Distribution channel. And that was actually part of the strategy to own
at
that.
At the start, it wasn't so much strategy as a reaction. We didn't have the money to open in 7-Eleven. You know, they take listing fees, they take product fees, they take shelf space, you got to buy the space. We didn't have that money, and they take credit terms. So when they take your product, they're only going to pay you 1, 2, 3 months later, depending on which buyer you're working with.
So you needed the cash flow.
You don't have the cash.
Yeah.
You know, at our stores, whatever product we sell is cash. We take it, we bank it, we can use it to pay people, or pay suppliers, or buy more product.
So it's out of necessity.
It's out of necessity. We had no choice. I like to claim credit for it, but I can't.
Yeah.
We did it because it was the only way we knew how to engage with our customers at that point with the resources we had. But it worked out wonderfully because it allowed us to gather feedback. It allowed us to live in real time. It allowed us to engage our customers in a way that no other brand did.
I would say the main competitor would be Irvin's, right?
Well, yes and no. I think Irvin's is playing the salted egg space, right? Mm-hmm. They are definitely playing very heavily into the tourism space. But yeah. I think the difference between us is that, first and foremost, Golden Duck is a gourmet snacks brand. Mm-hmm. And we've taken the chance to pivot with our chili crab. We've pivoted because we use salted egg crab, which is a very recognizable seafood flavor. We use real crab in there. But we also pivoted it by releasing two flavors at the same time, saying salted egg crab, chili crab. And Singapore's chili crab is one of our most iconic dishes. So we still have pipeline, man. We are still going to be launching exciting new flavors. Can't tell you just yet, but it's coming soon. It's coming
soon.
So you're
basically, so you've now defined your space as gourmet snacks and not salted egg
That's
snacks,
right.
which is what you guys...
So that is the first key difference between Golden Duck and Irvin's. The second key difference is that they cater to tourism crowds. How can you pay that price for that grammage consistently? The Golden Duck is the locals' champion. People that live here, breathe here, eat here, will buy Golden Duck. People that are buying for their friends who live overseas will buy Irvin's, and that's fine. So they're great for market education, but I guess we're just going to become the people's favorite, and that's what our goal has always been.
The one thing which I think, well, I guess, I don't know who was the first in this, but the both of you, I would say changed the way I see consumer packaged goods is the whole fact that you had your own distribution channel, because this is usually just in NTUC on Cold Storage, right? But then suddenly when I started seeing like you guys pop up, I'm like, this almost is like an Old Chunky.
Yeah.
And that to me is to have your own distribution channel, I think it's actually a pretty strong asset. But,
yeah, it's so counterintuitive, right?
Yeah.
Because you don't expect your own sales channels to be big movers of products, but they are. They actually contribute a good, I would say, maybe I shouldn't say.
But it's a good proportion.
They contribute to the bottom line. And that is something that took us by surprise.
Yeah.
Especially when we started learning about the space that we're in, the FMCG space.
Yeah.
I think that really just shows you the amount of loyalty that your customers have to your product and to your brand.
Yeah. So on that note, a couple more things about the Golden Duck. You talk about loyalty to customers and everything.
Yeah.
What are some of the challenges though? I mean, in general, it sounds like it's been a rapid ride for the Golden Duck.
Very rapid.
But I'm sure there's been some challenges along the way.
Oh yeah, man. I wouldn't even call them speed bumps. They're kind of like potholes that break your car down.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be anything. It could be anything, because when you're playing in the premium space, your customers are going to be the most demanding, thorough customers. If you're going to give them a soggy chip, they will know it. And they will call you out.
So QC has been difficult?
QC has become an enormous part of this company, more so than other companies.
Yeah.
I would dare say the amount that we spend on QC is close to $50,000 a month.
And
that is enormous.
I would say, was that one of your first hires, like a QC manager?
Our QA came in at the same time as our factory manager. So that tells you exactly how important QA is.
Yeah.
QA stands for quality assurance.
Yeah.
They create the systems, the governance. QC is the checkpoint. So QC team, QA team, they go hand in hand. Very, very necessary, especially in this industry. I think there are a lot of companies that hire PR teams to handle scandals, scares, cockroaches, lizards. We've seen them in our competitors.
Yeah.
But we don't believe in letting the brand take those hits. You're selling a $7 product. You're selling an $8 product. You should not be letting your customers see things like that.
Yeah, QA is difficult. Especially you're going international, and especially across the distribution channel internationally as well, there'll be some issues there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was reading this book recently, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, and it's very interesting because it brings across the premise of responsibility and separating that from fault.
Yeah.
So those are two very different things, although they usually come together. So in this instance, it might not be your fault if a little snail appears on one of your supplier's packets that they're supplying to you, potatoes, curry leaves, chili, whatever it is, there's a small snail there. It's not your fault, but I'll be damned if I don't claim that it's my responsibility to get it out of my packets, right? So that is a very clear difference. It's not our fault whether or not something like that happens, but it's our responsibility to take it to our customers. With this brand, we have to represent that.
Yeah. So we've got 5 minutes. I've got 4 questions, so I think we should make it.
Let's
so
do this.
Question I have is also about internationalization. I mean, you guys grew rapidly, and it's really hard to find growth in this space. You went Philippines first, I think, or Hong Kong first and Philippines.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which way.
Philippines first.
And you've gone on your own, right? There's no partner or anything.
In Philippines, we have a partner. Hong Kong, we've worked with a couple of different people. China, we're working with a partner.
And was this always the plan to go this way, or just...
I think it's just growth. You know, there's no name for it. There's no, there's a plan, right? But the plan evolves. The plan continues to evolve depending on what the market presents you with. If we want to do it ourselves, but the market proves challenging, we may look for a distribution partner. If the market is open, you know, we may do it ourselves, right? And I think every market presents its own opportunities and every market presents its own costs. And we have to evaluate that and just move as best as we can, as fast as we can.
And were Philippines and Hong Kong always your first target, or is sort of the opportunity came with a local
Philippines
partner?
Philippines is a natural market because the Filipinos in Singapore love salted egg and they look to Singapore as the gourmet snack or the gourmet food provider in the region. So that was a natural move. Hong Kong, for very different reasons, it was the next target. China, Indo, Thailand, you know, all of these are great places to be at different points in time. So how we expand, it's really a matter of which market wants us most at that point.
And I suppose on that note as well, like, you've gone in three plus 4 years, you've gone from 2%, 3% to a couple of hundred at this point with international staff, temporary staff.
Close to, yeah, close to.
So your leadership style has evolved, I'm guessing.
Yeah,
and
very different.
So what are you now versus three years ago?
When we first started the Golden Duck, it was a lot of DIY. I used to drive the vans, sometimes I drive my own car for deliveries, man. You know, you don't have enough
vans.
You're
cutting the potatoes as well. And
yeah, slice the potatoes yourself, fry the chips, grind the salted egg yolk. Right now, my leadership style has evolved, and it was a continual adaptation over 2017, 2018. I think this will continue as we move forward. But it's become very delegate. Is that the right word?
Very delegated, yeah.
Where I trust my team to do their best work, and I come back and I check on it every now and then. And I always look to help them with the process, improve the process that they're going through, and empower the team. So if we need new people, we need good people, there's a reason why we have 15 positions open for Golden Duck. That's crazy. Always expanding. And right now I focus on the people, I focus on the system. I don't actually do a lot of the day-to-day work myself, except for obvious things that I can't hand off, like BD discussions, you know, strategic partner discussions, or finance approvals, things like that. You're just gonna have to do it yourself. Everything else, you trust people, you trust the system, work on the system. I think empowering people is the next phase of growth in any company that hires a bunch of millennials like us.
Yeah. So I guess on that note, if you look forward, right, like, I guess on a personal note, what are some things you still want to work on? And you also told me about, like, you want to look more on social entrepreneurship and stuff like that. Like,
yeah,
personal things you want to work on, and also projects that you want to work on.
For me, Golden Duck represents the growth phase of not just the business, but also my life. This is where we build, we make things happen. The next stage will be a diversification. I think there are other markets, exciting industries to be in, and I want to just touch on that for at least a good 3 to 5 years. And after that, I'm 26 now, but at that point I aim to be about 33 to 35. When I finish the diversification phase, you know, being at least in one or two other industries, one or two other markets, I want to then focus really on social entrepreneurship. What does this mean? It's really about creating sustainable businesses that give back. I have a very heavy focus on infrastructure. I think that is one of the most sustainable ways to build into communities of developing countries. Because when I was young, I went on a mission trip with my parents to Cambodia, and I realized how fleeting that was. The impact that we gave them, the medicine that we gave, the goods that we gave will last them for weeks and no more. But if you're talking about real sustainable change, it not only has to drive long-term results, but it also has to drive long-term profits, because I'm only counting on my own funds to do this again and again and again.
And I guess one final thing is, when you think about your journey, right, like, I think a lot of it can be taught in school, but do you have any mind on trying to grow the entrepreneurship space in Singapore by going to schools or something? And
I don't know. I can deliver talks, I can give them an idea of what goes on in my head. Maybe not much. Maybe that's why we get to this stage, right? Because you got to be a bit crazy to make things happen like this. But schools are definitely one of the best mediums to talk to the next generation. Doesn't mean you're going to reach them and turn them into game changers or rebels, or dropouts like me. Maybe. Maybe not. But it's the right place to start.
Yeah. We're exactly at time, so thanks so much for taking the time.
Wasn't that a wonderful conversation? I just love the passion that Chris has for his business. But more than that, I love how, despite all his success, Chris hasn't changed from the guy whom I met all those years ago when we first started bonding over tennis. He's still down to earth, driven, and has no airs about himself. It's not surprising at all to me that Chris and his co-founder, John, first bonded over values and ethics. Thanks again, Chris, for sharing your experiences so candidly and openly. Now, if you like what you hear, then please subscribe and tell everyone that we're here. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and your favorite podcast apps. And get in touch with us through the Bold But Gold social media channels if there are specific stories you'd like to hear. We'll be back again real soon with another episode about Singaporeans who are making bold choices in their lives. Till then, stay bold but gold.